The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
27 kilometers tunnel underground, designed with mind to send protons around. A circle that passes through Switzerland and France. 60 nations contribute to scientific advance. Two beams of protons being round through the ring they ride, till in the hearts of the detectors that made it collide, and all the energy packed in such a tiny bit of room becomes mass particles created from the vacuum. And then,
oh yeah.
LHCBs is where the antimatter's gone. Alan looks at collisions with a lead ion. PMS and Atlas are two of a kind. They're looking for whatever new particles they can find. The LHC accelerates the protons in the lead, and the things that it discovers will rock you in the head. We see asteroids and planets, stars galore. We know a black hole resides at each galaxy's core. But even all that matter cannot explain what holds all these stars together. Something else remains. The star matter interacts only through gravity. And until you catch a particle, there's no way to see.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, bringing you into this week's edition of Inside the Black Box with the LHC wrap. That's the Large Hadron Collider wrap. All right, Bill, what do you think of that thing?
I thought it was pretty good. I don't know what kind of dance you do. Is it a booty shake or is it a beta particle shake? Beta.
I have no
alpha
idea.
Alpha particle shake, beta particle shake.
But actually, our guest today reminded us that they are doing tests of the Hadron Super Collider there in the corner of Switzerland and France. And believe it or not, if you've logged on to Google this week, you saw a cartoon schematic of the Hadron Super Collider, in case you were wondering what that goofy cartoon was. And it's only fitting because, 2 weeks ago we got a call from a listener?
Last week.
Yeah, last week,
yeah, and they were asking, is it worth the money? And it's
that rap, it certainly is.
Well, as long as you get that song out of it, that'll pay
I'm sure
for everything.
It'll go platinum.
But it was $8 billion spent over 10 years, maybe, and the war in Iraq is costing us $12 billion a month. So
by that standard,
I'd say it's okay.
Excellent value,
yeah.
And a potential platinum
yeah,
album.
Yeah, just stay in Iraq, you know, four weeks less, and we got ourselves a super collider.
So for our fellow geeks out there listening who are interested in the Hadron Super Collider, we will actually, hopefully on October 1st, have Eric Prebis from the Fermi National Accelerator Lab in to talk about colliders and other interesting thoughts about perpetual motion machines. So ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ledovitz with my ever effervescent co-host, a man who's so environmentally conscious he actually styles his hair with biodiesel, Bill Hunt.
You found my beauty secret.
Is that it?
Yeah, it's just French fry grease. That's what biodiesel
is. So you don't even process it, you just take it.
Just take the grease.
That's why
the
lard.
You know,
okay.
You get at the old frying and
so
stuff
that
like that.
So that explains the smell.
Works really well. Yes.
Okay. So, and I think we would call French fry grease or certainly hair gel a complex fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the title of today's show, The Goo in Your Shampoo, where goo would be the technical term for what our guest is going to talk about today, complex fluids. Our guest joining us today is Victor Breedfeld from the faculty of the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering here at Georgia Tech. He received his master's and PhDs in applied physics at University of Twente in the Netherlands and went on to do postdoctoral work in the field of complex fluids at the University of California, Santa Barbara in the Department of Chemical Engineering. And his research theme is the structure and rheology of complex fluids, investigating the structure and mechanical strength of materials that are neither simple Newtonian fluids nor elastic solids. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Stuff that's between.
Can we get a definition back?
We are going to get a definition. Will you keep your shorts on?
I will keep my shorts on as I always do.
So,
rheology. Rheology?
Victor, welcome to the program.
Yeah, welcome.
Thanks, Pete. Thanks, Bill.
Before
all right, now, before Bill jumps out of his stool
and
turns on you like
rheology.
A pack of dingoes.
No, yeah,
So what is a complex fluid and what is rheology?
So the easiest thing to think about complex fluids is think about your probably fifth grade definitions that you learned about the phases.
All right, so you're at about the right level for Bill and I, fifth grade.
Yes, that's what I figured.
The best year of my life.
Yeah. When people talk about a solid, a liquid, and a gas, they often use a definition that a solid is something that maintains its shape. If you put a chunk of metal into a little container, it will just maintain its original shape. A liquid is something that takes the shape of the container. So if you pour water in a beaker, it will take the shape of the beaker. And a gas is something that you cannot contain in an open beaker. If you try to maintain oxygen gas in a beaker, it will just flow out. The molecules don't interact strongly enough to stay together. But there is a whole world in between the liquid and the solid of materials that you can't really answer the question, is this a liquid or a solid? And a good example is mayonnaise. If you have a jar of mayonnaise in your fridge, you take a scoop out of it, and you go back 2 weeks later, you can still see where you took that scoop out of it. So obviously, it doesn't adjust to the shape of the container, because then it should have become flat again. But would anybody really call mayonnaise a solid?
Well, after it's been in Bill's fridge for 3 months, yes, but otherwise, no.
Exactly, and that is what the area that I'm most interested in my research, and that's the area of complex fluids. There are always good examples to play with as kids. You've all played with some gooey materials. There's a famous recipe using borax and what are the other ingredients?
Polyvinyl alcohol.
That you can pull off the web and play with your kids with. Silly putty is another good example. Silly putty, if you put it on the table, it will flow. It will take the shape of the container or the shape of the table, just a flat pancake. That's liquid-like behavior. But if you throw it against the wall, it comes back as if it is a rubber bouncy ball. That's more like a solid. And depending on how you look at it, you can either call it a liquid or a solid, and those are all complex fluids. And you'll see them everywhere around you.
So then rheology would be the study of complex fluids.
Yeah, technically... rheology would be described as the flow and deformation, studying the flow and deformation of materials. According to the spell checker on Word, they always like to replace it with theology. So every now and then we
run... The theology of rheology.
Yeah. Every now and then we run into abstracts for conferences that say the theology of ketchup.
Oh, because they just did the spell check. And yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. But also mechanical engineers, three was too large of a number for them, so they consider air to be a fluid.
Yeah, and by one definition,
they can't. Amputees have fingers cut off, something like that. I don't know. They can't count.
I have to keep it simple. They just have solids and fluids.
Yeah.
And we have solids, liquids, and gases, I guess, that gives chemical engineers a leg up.
Yeah, because they got that third thing going
and
on.
And rheologists, I have four with the complex fluids in there, so...
Okay, all right.
You have to be able to count to four to become a rheologist.
Wow, okay.
All right, so let me...
You do need to know math.
Let me take a segue before we get into the wackiness of silly putty and that whole borate cross-linked polyvinyl alcohol, which you out there in the land of our listeners would call either slime or gack if you have young kids who like
GAC.
You know... Leave it on your pillow, on your bed, and you fall asleep on that stuff. And
I'm
it
not familiar with GAC.
Yeah, GAC, phloem, slime. These are
slime. I've heard.
They sold that when I was a kid. I never.
Slime's the lower viscosity one. GAC is the higher viscosity one, and phloem is where you put polystyrene foam beads in it. And it's actually a good exhibition of how a composite works.
Which one is most likely to choke a child, though?
I'm guessing phloem.
Okay,
yeah,
mine,
definitely.
Or it might be you after your
15,
kid.
They don't go
you know,
for that. So,
leaves
yeah.
it in your beer glass.
Yeah,
and you
right.
You
I choke
somehow
on
the,
it. Yeah,
the stuff comes out. Right. All right, let's take a quick segue now that we're getting to wacky areas of science into this week's Science in the News. And this week's Science in the News article comes from the Wall Street Journal, Thursday, September 4th of last week. It's entitled, Two Protons Walk into a Black Hole and Other Jokes Physicists Tell by Alexandra Alter. It was right on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Not the kind of thing you expect to see there. But what they point out is over in CERN, and this the article actually mentions that the communications personnel over there put together that rap.
CERN is the
European Nuclear Research
Center
Organization, but it's French.
But they speak backwards over there, so the center goes in the first, and then they tell you
all
what
right, Victor's
about.
But those are the guys who brought you the internet.
Yeah.
Oh, basically. Not DARPA?
and not Al Gore.
Not Al Gore? Wow.
All right. Well, Al helped funded it, I think.
He did.
But
he
that's
did.
About
he
it.
Did. He didn't never claim to have created
it. All right. So the article out of Meyrin, Switzerland begins, one recent Saturday morning, physicists here shot the first beam of subatomic matter into the most powerful particle accelerator ever built. In a nearby auditorium, though, another groundbreaking experiment was underway, improvisational comedy boot camp, where 25 researchers stood in a circle and awkwardly eyed one another. One of them told a physics joke, which is funnier if you're familiar with bosons and hadrons, types of subatomic particles. In fact, Victor was telling me that joke in the elevator before we came over here. The whole idea is that a guy by the name of Bob Stanek over there has done what a lot of people in business have done for 30 years. He got someone by the name of Charna Halpern, and she's a pioneer in the improvisational comedy world. I actually own one of her improv comedy books.
Have you read it?
I actually have. It's all about exercises.
Is this the one by the Bible?
Well, I don't know. She co-wrote one on exercises and improv comedy, and she's probably written others.
Okay.
But, I mean, she has taught people from...
I've seen her video of comedy exercise video.
Oh, well, is this something Lou Lefton has?
I'm just making this up. No, it's just comedy exercise videos.
All right, so we're 5 minutes into the show, and you're jerking my chain already.
Roll with me.
Okay, all right. So she's taught people like Tina Fey, Mike Myers, and Stephen Colbert. And the idea is for... improv comedy to brainwash these physicists into actually agreeing with one another, right? Because in improv, someone throws out an idea, you're not allowed to say, okay, that's a bad idea, and shift gears.
Right.
You have to embrace it.
You have
it.
To accept what is offered.
And our guest, Victor Breefeld, who is trained in physics, what do you think about the idea of physicists actually agreeing with each other? I've seen physicists in the room trying to agree with each other.
As long as there's only one in the room, it will work.
Okay, there you go. There you go. So maybe it is a good thing, and they are hoping that this will help them come up with new and innovative ideas for outreach to explain why CERN is important, and that's exactly what our caller asked about last week. So, and believe it or not, we hope to have some guys from Solvay Polymers on the show a few months down the road who do this sort of thing. We're actually working with them to take improv and stand-up comedy ideas to generate new ideas, and that should prove to be a wacky show.
Yeah.
All right, so now... back to complex fluids.
Right.
So can you give us an example of a complex fluid that we might see in a consumer product that we'd use?
Yes. As I said, you see them all around you. I've actually worked with a local elementary school teacher to put a fifth grade unit together that is called Supermarket Science. And that really, the title of that really shows you that you see it all around you. But a simple example to mention and to look at the materials that you see and get in the supermarket or your local hardware store from a different viewpoint.
Or that would be the liquor store for you, Bill.
Do they have complex? I guess Southern
Baileys.
Southern Baileys.
Yeah,
okay, Baileys.
Some of the margarita mixes, maybe.
There you go. Okay.
But an example, one of the examples that sort of sketches the idea of how you use these properties to your advantage is maybe paint. If you just imagine on Saturday morning, you go to Home Depot, you pick up your paint, they add the color to it that your wife has told you that the paint should be.
Well, you got that right. The color that your wife has told you it will be.
I've been married long enough.
Yes.
Yeah. The answer is yes, whatever color you want to paint that.
So, and when they do that, they mix it, and you get home, and you get distracted. You land in the couch watching Saturday football, and 3 weeks later, you... get nudged along to finally go and paint that wall, and you open that can of paint. Well, what you do not want to find is that all the pigment particles are lying in the bottom of that paint can. So somehow they have to engineer that paint so that it is very thick, very viscous, so that all these particles stay suspended. It's nice and homogeneous. You don't have to mix it up. You can just stick in your brush and go. But then you can imagine that if you have it on your brush and you paint it on the wall, you don't want it to feel like molasses. It shouldn't have the consistency of molasses. So the paint should be engineered in such a way that when it gets squeezed between the brush and the wall, it becomes very thin. It is almost as thin as water is. But then when you take your brush off again, you don't want it to be thin as water because then it will drain down the wall and form these nasty drips and taint your furniture. So then it has to become thick again. And all of this has to happen on exactly the right timescales because if it goes too quick, or too slow, then it really doesn't work. So people who design paints, companies who sell you all their paint, they really care about this. They care about how to engineer these properties so that it goes from very viscous to not so viscous and very viscous in a way that, that makes your life as a consumer convenient.
Now, being the historian that I am, well...
I thought you were just old.
I'm just old? Leonardo da Vinci and I used to play golf together.
All right,
but
there you go.
No, I mean, so he did a lot of experimenting with different kind of products or materials for artwork. Is there much in the history on what he might have done with paint and things he might have done? I know he had a competition to do frescoes with Michelangelo, and neither one of the things lasted because they were trying to outdo the other one on some crafty way to do the material for a fresco, and they didn't stand the test of time. But
I'm not really aware of any well-documented rheology from by Michelangelo or Da Vinci. But it's definitely true. I mean, I think all of us here in this room are old enough that when you think back 15 years or 20 years and you would open a can of paint, you would have to stir for a long time.
Yeah,
you would have to stir for a couple of minutes to really get all the particles suspended. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, you can literally open it and you stir it just for out of habit. But it really is not that necessary anymore.
They engineered that.
Really?
Yeah.
I still, I do it.
Right.
And that's another product for which that is true is actually chocolate milk. There, you really used to have to shake it up like
they
crazy.
They put paint particles in chocolate milk?
Yeah.
Only your chocolate milk.
Okay.
And it's got lead in it, too, Bill, which explains a lot.
Okay.
The brown paint particles. How do you think chocolate milk gets its color?
Whoa, okay.
But these particles used to go to the bottom and form this thick cake of chocolate at the bottom, and you would have to shake really hard to do it. But what they do now is they have actually engineered a sugar network that is strong enough so that it can keep the particles suspended. Gravity is not strong enough to pull these particles to the bottom anymore. Mm-hmm. But when the network is not strong enough that it prevents flow. So when you tilt the bottle over and the weight of the chocolate milk is behind it, that network breaks. But you put it down again and the network reforms itself.
So is this that they add sugar to the milk?
They add some sugars to it that don't add much to the calorie count.
But are the long-chain sugars?
They're longer-chain sugars.
Interesting.
There are molecules that we would refer to as polymers, really, really long, sort of spaghetti-like molecules.
Sucrose.
Right, so sucrose is what, a dimer of a sugar? That's two units. But starches, these kinds of things.
Right.
Right. Huh. Wow. Hey. That's amazing.
I'm craving chocolate milk until we run out.
Yeah, that's an application that's near and dear to my heart.
So
far we've actually learned a few things already. So you kept talking about the word viscous. So viscosity, can we interchange that with the thickness of a fluid?
Pretty much. I mean, in most people's mind is sort of the ease with which you can stir something. Like water is very low viscosity. Honey has a higher viscosity.
Right, right.
And
so it doesn't pour as easily, the stirring. Right. So if you're trying to pour molasses, it slowly comes out. So it's very viscous, and water, not so viscous, so it pours out very easily.
Yeah.
But so you're talking about something where the viscosity depends on how fast you push on it.
Yes.
Right. And so you rheology people would call how fast you push on it what? The shear?
They call it the shear rate.
Right, right. How fast? So usually shearing, you think of it as sort of, clipping along the top and, pushing it sideways, like a brush would do.
So yeah, if you think about that liquid that's in between the brush and the wall, the poor paint layer that is in between there, if you move your brush very fast, that would be high shear rate. And if you move it really slowly, that would be a lower shear rate.
Okay, so that's what we're talking about when we talk about shear rate, how fast you push on it. And what you're talking about then is what? A shear thinning fluid.
Yes.
When you talk about paint.
A lot of materials that you, shampoos are a good example of that. It's actually a pretty thick consistency when you see it in the bottle and you sort of shake the bottle around a little bit. But then when you squirt it out, it actually flows pretty easily.
Right.
And actually, the sheer thinning of shampoos leads to a very, very funny phenomenon that you can actually, this is a do-it-yourself at home experiment. The next time you go in the shower, take your shampoo and pour it out really, really slowly so that there is just a very thin thread of shampoo pouring down on your hand. And if you look then closely at the puddle of shampoo formed on your hand, you'll actually see that liquid jumps around. The thin thread comes down, and it just doesn't land as if it is a puddle of water. But it actually bounces.
Mm-hmm.
It forms this weird heap, and it bounces, and it jumps around. And that's called the K effect. And that is directly related to the shear thinningness. There are actually some cool movies out there. I think it's spelled K-A-Y-E. If you type K effect into YouTube,
so this is
I'm
named
sure you'll
after
find it.
Somebody who discovered the effect? Okay, because it sounds like something out of James Bond.
Or is named by somebody that can't spell K.
Irish Moneypenny. It's the K effect.
And I tested this at home before coming over here. It works for the Suave brand body wash and shampoos.
Oh, okay, cool. So save a little money.
But not
and
the Walmart imitation baby shampoo.
The funny thing is when I was back in the Netherlands and I got my graduate degree, my professor always used to bring home American shampoos because they would be really good at this K effect.
Mm-hmm.
European shampoos wouldn't do it.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know what the difference is, but it must be a subtle formulation.
Bill thinks it's a plot, some government thing. I don't know.
It's
sheer thinning shampoo. It's
it's emerging as a bald spot in the bottom part.
All right, but for those of us that don't really use shampoo, I'll borrow my wife's. I just buff my head with carnauba wax, and that keeps me for the week. But Bill, this will force you to actually shower.
Which is also probably a complex fluid, right?
Yeah, I would think it would be.
The wax would be. Is that, right. Yeah, so is wax considered a complex fluid, or is that a simple solid?
Well, it's definitely a complex fluid that's more on the side of the solids than on the side of the liquids. Right. I mean, most people would think of shampoo as a more something leaning towards the liquids, and wax as something that leans towards the solids. But they're actually in that gray area between what people would normally truly define as solids and liquids.
So how does its rheology properties affect its utility as a shampoo? So outside of keeping you occupied in the shower.
Looking at the K effect
and,
in the shower.
And by the way, that wastewater, folks, I don't really
Bill, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I'm looking at the K effect.
Yeah,
honey.
Right. So where's that drop button for the 10 seconds? Because he said that. But, how does that affect the operation of the shampoo or how well the shampoo works?
Well, from a viewpoint of a manufacturer, what they really like to do is in a bottle of shampoo sell you as much water as possible. Water is cheap. If you're selling margarine,
do they actually have meetings?
Yeah, you
want to
sell
like
oil,
sell water.
Margarine. We're gonna discuss how to add more nicotine to the cigarettes, and then next topic on the agenda is how to add more water to the shampoo.
It's not just the economics, right? So a sheer thing, thinning.
That's easy for you to say.
Sheer winning. Okay, a sheer thinning fluid makes sense because for a paint, you want to be able to push it on, but when you spread it on the ceiling, you don't want it to drip. Mm-hmm. A toothpaste, for example, same thing. You want it to sit on the brush, but then when you...
But when you slop it up on the ceiling,
slide
you don't really want it to come... You
on your tooth, you want it to move, right? So sheer thinning makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And to that end, you've got an interesting toothpaste story, don't you?
Yeah, actually, some of the research in my group is driven by a toothpaste disaster that one of the large consumer product manufacturers...
That was 1918, wasn't it? The toothpaste disaster of 1918?
Yes. It was actually more like 2006.
Okay. Right. Oh, wow. It's a recent disaster. Right.
They set Lake Erie on fire because of this.
They had a brilliant idea to really change their formulations so that they would make a brand of toothpaste that had all different of active ingredients so that you don't have just a separate for white teeth, or anti-plaque, or with cinnamon taste, but that they could combine it all in once. And they hadn't worked
out.
Put
some Viagra in there, too.
that's what the blue parts of it are.
Okay, the little blue particles.
Okay.
Sorry.
But the problem that they didn't run into a problem. It worked all fine. They packed an entire warehouse full of shampoo, and they were actually going to launch
Donald
Trump's show.
It's toothpaste, right?
It's toothpaste.
All right, we're on toothpaste. Because you said shampoo before.
Oh, shampoo.
And Bill, incidentally, does brush his teeth with shampoo.
Yeah. My mom used to make me do that when I was a kid.
But anyway, they packed that entire warehouse full of toothpaste, and they were going to launch it on Donald Trump's The Apprentice show. It was going to make a big deal out of it. And about a week before the show, someone goes into that warehouse. He opens one of the tubes of toothpaste and squeezes as hard as he can, but the stuff doesn't come out.
Whereupon Trump chimed in, "You're fired."
I don't think Trump really got to hear about this, but I'm sure someone got fired over this. And what really had happened is that they just didn't know well enough how their new formulation would interact with each other, how the rheology would evolve over time. And everything worked fine until they squeezed it through the high shear filling apparatus that they fill these tubes with at an incredible rate.
Right.
And something changed, and it all of a sudden became much more of a solid than you really want your toothpaste to be.
Right.
It paid for some graduate students in my group, so that was
great.
The good news. It
became
great.
A tooth brick instead of a toothpaste.
So what you're saying is not only is the thickness, the viscosity of something dependent on shear, but the shear history can actually affect these things.
Yeah, it makes, for a lot of these materials, it is very important what you did to them during their lifetime. And for at least a lot of product manufacturers, that is one of the key issues that they like to investigate.
Yeah.
If you have a shelf life of a couple of months or up to 6 months for some products, you need to know that when someone goes into the store and buys it after 6 months, they still find the same properties as you would.
Oh, so when they made it in the lab, it could sit around. But when they shot it out of a really small, hole, very fast, that's a high shear rate, you change it. So, for example, if you have polymers in there, you can align the polymers.
Yep.
They can crystallize. They can do different things than they would if they were just sitting around like the mayonnaise in the jar.
That was what was responsible for this mistake.
So you've essentially got some history there built into the toothpaste. Is that correct?
Yes.
So if you have a roommate, you might be able to figure out if they used your toothpaste by looking at the history.
If they squeeze it out very, very fast.
If you give it to your geeky friend who's a rheologist, they might be figuring out whether it has been
used.
They've
been playing with your toothpaste, and you can figure that out pretty easily. So.
Well, so what'd they
do? It's useful.
What'd they do with the toothpaste thing?
They just had to, in the end, what they did is they added a new test to their battery of testing, which was... shooting the toothpaste through a very thin, small hole in the lab so that they could see what the effect of it was. That was the practical answer.
Right.
The fundamental answer was that they funded some research, among other places in my group, to figure out how can we prevent this from happening. So we don't have to do the post-mortem analysis, but that we can actually have some fundamental knowledge
now,
about it.
Now, was this a chemical reaction that took place?
More of a, just a physical reconfiguration.
So wasn't it the chemical layer? It was a chemical process. It wasn't molecular. It was just intermolecular.
It was on the it was more intermolecular forces. Huh. No chemical reactions.
Right.
And that's also the reason why they thought they were fine. They can predict chemical reactions. They didn't expect anything to happen.
Right.
But just the fact that they squeezed it through the nozzle actually messed up their product.
Now, did it undergo a phase change because of the higher pressure? Or?
No. I mean, the technical answer to this was is that there is a very small amount of water in toothpaste, and they have a thickener in there. A lot of places use gums like xanthan gum. As one of the ingredients that you'll see listed on there. And that xanthan gum will become thicker if it gets more water available. What happened here is that it swelled.
That's right.
It started swelling more because of being sheared. But that's too technical, probably, for today's show.
No,
right. But basically, the water gets in there, and hydrogen bonds between the different molecules makes a big network of this gum.
Okay. That's what happens.
So if you see xanthan gum, guar gum, cellulose gum, carrageenan, these are all... these sort of mainly gummy polysaccharides, sugars, that will stick together. The good news is, in case you're thinking it's something that oozes out of Jabba the Hutt, they're all natural plant extracts, right? They come from trees.
Tree sap, right.
Carrageenan comes from seaweed and things like that.
Really?
So don't be freaked out.
Alginate from seaweed.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, they're cheap sources of very efficient modifiers of the thickness of something. As I said, you want to sell as much water as you can. It's better if you have a product like this that you can just add a small amount of an ingredient that makes it nice and thick.
See, now you got the conspiracy.
They got the conspiracy theory.
Right. Bill will be blogging
it's
about
just
this
nothing but
later
water.
Today.
Yeah. It's 100% water.
So what you're saying though is that Mother Nature does a lot of this as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, rheology is functional. It's not just something that we invented to keep ourselves in business. And you can think of something like a synovial fluid. That is the fluid that is in your knee and that lubricates the joints.
Or what used to be in Bill's knees. We're not so sure anymore.
You've seen me walk, obviously.
And if it's really not there, your knees won't last very long. Right. But you can imagine that the way your knee is positioned, that if the liquid that's in there would be really thin under all circumstances, that it would just drain down.
Right.
Would all end up in your big toe.
Right.
But you really need to keep it in the joint. And the way nature has engineered that is that, again, if you're at rest and there is no shear on it, that it is very thick fluid. And then when you start walking and you put shear on it, it very quickly becomes extremely thin. But when you stop walking and you stand still, it immediately becomes thick again. And that's and nature uses the same kind of polymers that these consumer product companies use modify their shampoos and their toothpastes.
All right, well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Let's take a quick break here, and after the break, let me remind our listeners that we will be taking calls. So if you've got a question for Victor Breedfeld about complex fluids or silly putty or whether or not Bill still brushes his teeth with shampoo, give us a call here at WREK at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-BENT.
BINT
2468. Or if you're listening to the program on the website, WREK.org, of course, that number is listed there. We'll be right back after this break on Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
I got a bongo too.
That's what I want to talk to you about. Hear that? It's one of the most exciting sounds in the world. Bongo. Everybody's doing it. Ouch! Well, everybody's trying to do it. But now anyone, and that means you, can really play bongos. Your teacher will be Mr. Bongo himself, Jack Costanzo. It's easy. It's exciting. It's fun. Listen.
For more bongo, tune into the Saturday Night Cocktail Lounge right here on WREK, Saturday nights from 8 to 10 p.m.
Like it? Well, you can do it. Mr. Bongo will teach you.
Are you a lover of African music? Are you enthralled with the skill of the great Malian artists such as Ale Faki Touré, Oumou Sangaré, and Issa Bagayogo? Do you bounce to the beat of the highlight masters such as King Sunny Ade, Prince Nico Mbarga, and Tony Allen? Or are you amazed by the skill of the great Cape Verdean vocalists such as Cesare Evora, Sarah Tavares, and Laura? Maybe you are just interested in finding out about the top African artists that are coming through town, and you'd like to win free tickets to those events. Then listen to Sub-Saharan Vibes at 91.1 FM from 9 to 10 p.m. every Monday. We satisfy all those desires and more as we give you the very best African music ranging from soukous to township, Makossa to Afropop, here on WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta, where we have a caller, thereby proving that people are fascinated by complex fluids. So, caller, are you there? Hello.
Hello.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Hey, you're on the air. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yes, very interested in the subject of phrenology and probably for non-scientific reasons. I'm a painter, an oil painter.
Oh, great.
And the phrenology is a word that I came across a while back because I was trying to get a thickening of paint on my canvas, what we artists call impasto, which means a paste.
And you're talking about oil paints, right?
Oil paint, yes. Right. And I guess it would be the same problem working with acrylic paints. So what I'm trying to do is have a thick enough paint so that my brush strokes are plainly visible to the viewer in order to get some textural effects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there are various kinds of mediums that I can use with the oil paint to get this. Sometimes, however, the paint gets so thick that I can't get it off the brush onto my canvas. And this creates a problem because I can smear it on with a knife, and then I have to texture it, and sometimes I'm pulling a lot of it up.
Okay, because with a knife, you get more of a flat stroke. You don't get the brush texture.
Exactly. Right. So what's the chemistry involved so that I can get it, work with a thick paint? Is it, mm-hmm. is it a matter of phrenology where or viscosity when I'm working with it thinly so that it, you know, when it finally gets onto the canvas, it's in a thick state. It remains in that thick state.
So it's a good question for Victor. Can he add? Is it a matter of adding something else to the paint?
Oil paint.
Obviously,
sure,
if you heat it up, you would. But he doesn't want to sit there and.
No, the easiest answer would be just to remove some of the solvent in there. I mean, the easiest way for an acrylic paint would just be to let it sit out for a while,
sure,
and evaporate some of the water until it gets thick enough to do what you want. And if it gets too thick, you just add a little bit of water back in.
So I thought it was too thick.
But now it was too thick. So if you get to a too thick oil-based paint, the easiest thing to do would be to add in some oil again. And you can probably use a few drips of even veggie oil work. But you have to be very careful, because if you add too much in there, then you immediately end up on the other side of the spectrum again. And most of the times, these materials only need a tiny, tiny, tiny amount. So you might even want to get a syringe or something and really add it one drop at a time very carefully until you get where you want to be.
Ah, I see. Well, I know I've been I've been too liberal, I guess, in my addition of oils.
Then it gets really nasty.
Well, then how am I going to get it? What about it sticking to the brush? So I sometimes I can't even get it off the brush to wipe on the canvas.
So let me tell you the do-it-yourself rheology test. One of the things you can do is just what you would call the finger tack test, and this is actually used by a lot of companies, by paint companies. You just put a little bit of paint between your fingertips, between your thumb and your finger, and you just pull those apart, and you get a good idea for the tackiness of the paint. And that might give you a feeling for what kind of consistency is desired. And it's a lot easier than getting it in your brush and getting it on a piece of canvas. You can just try it between your fingertips and then decide what is the kind of consistency that you want.
Okay, great suggestion. Now, here's an extension of this question. In cleaning the brushes using soap, does that create a residual surfactant that is now being, when I use that dry brush,
it's
is there
question.
A residual surfactant on the brush that causes the thick paint to collapse?
Could be. I would say rinse liberally with water after you clean it off with soap. But if there is still some remaining surfactant, there is not too much you can do about that. You can try to get it off by actually putting it in a mixture of a little bit of oil and water, and you'll force the surfactant to come off because it likes to be at the interface between the oil and the water. So you might be able to clean off your brush by putting it in a mixture of oil and water after you have really gotten all the paint.
You mean
off.
Like the oils that I use, like walnut and linseed oil?
Yeah, just a little bit of that with a little bit of water, and then see if you can force the surfactant to come off.
Yeah. Is it a matter, really, or is it just too incidental to worry about?
Well, you're the expert here. If it doesn't work on your brushes, if you really feel
it's
that
a fear,
it's a problem.
It's a fear more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The bigger thing that I would have is your brush is not entirely dry. It still has liquid in there. That might affect the paint.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thanks very much. I'll be listening to your continued discussion.
All
on
right.
This
Thank
fascinating
you. Thanks
subject.
Very much for calling.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
All right. There it is. We actually have to define something that a caller mentioned. Surfactant.
I was going to stop and. Yeah.
Soap.
Yeah.
Right? It's got one end that likes water, one end that likes oil. So when Victor was talking about taking a mixture of oil and water, one end likes to go by the oil droplet, one end likes to go in the water. Right. And in fact, it's surfactants that are often used with latex polymer particles to get it suspended in a latex paint.
You use it even if you have ever been inclined to make your own mayonnaise. Then
I've never been
you use actually
to make my own mayonnaise.
Vinegar.
Are you inclined to make your own mayonnaise?
It's too dangerous these days with all the salmonella out there.
Oh, because of the eggs.
Yeah, because of the eggs that you throw in there. But you mix a vinegar and an oil,
right.
And you use actually the egg as the surfactant so that you can stabilize the little droplets of oil that form.
Now, is this the same process if you buy, how to put it, if you buy peanut butter at a health food store? A lot of times the oil is completely separated from the other stuff, and that never happens with Jif. I mean, is that part of this? Is that a rheology kind of thing, or is that just I'm thinking too much about peanut butter? And
no,
you're
right.
Hungry. That's all
the
I can
extra
say,
15 yeah. ingredients or so that are probably listed on the Jif versus the health food have been designed to do exactly that and stabilize the oil in that system so that it just doesn't come.
Yeah, because I once in a great while, about every 6 months, I decide to be healthy and I might do something like get peanut butter for a health food store.
Yeah,
I open
it
and I go,
right
ooh, there's a pool of weird oil in there.
But the other thing they do is what is oil in that peanut butter, right? So these may have some sort of group at the end, but they have this long chain hydrocarbon.
I see that when I open the I take the lid off of the peanut butter.
The carbon-carbon bond sometimes will have a double bond in them, right? So that's called an unsaturated bond. It doesn't have all the possible hydrogens you have in it. And those things, because they put a little kink in the molecule, they can't crystallize and form something that's a solid at room temperature. So you often see hydrogenated oils. So the hydrogenated oils are what food manufacturers like to put in there. They make it a nice, uniform carbon-carbon bond, and it crystallizes. It's a solid at room temperature, which makes for great, nice, creamy, you know, foods, but it's bad health-wise to have too many of those hydrogenated oils. So that's why people are all up in arms about that sort of stuff. Yeah,
but so that's an example, sort of in the supermarket, like you said, where rheology comes into play.
But I mean, so what fraction of consumer products have some kind of viscosity modifier? I want to say 90% of them.
Yeah, anything that you that is that you can pour or squeeze to the form probably has a whole bunch of viscosity modifiers.
Right.
It's a huge market.
Yeah. So we've been talking about shear thinning fluids, fluids that when you push on them faster, they get runnier so you can spread the paint or the peanut butter or the toothpaste can move. But there are shear thickening fluids, right?
Yeah, there are not quite as many of them. It's always a little bit harder to come up with examples. But most people will know the example of cornstarch because it's something that is often used in schools to demonstrate. It's a really nice, kind of dirty experiment you get it all over your kid's
hands.
Your
kid comes home with white, cloudy residue all over his clothes. You know that's what they did.
You know what they did.
Yeah.
But really, by making a cornstarch, by adding some water to cornstarch, so that it reaches the consistency where there is just enough water in there so that you can stir it, but not more water than that, you can get to a state where if you try to stir it really quickly, it breaks up. It's brittle.
You can see it crack.
You can see it
fractures.
Crack.
Yeah.
But if you stir it very slowly, you can actually make it go through it. And one of the things you can do here is that if you pour it in your hands and you keep forming it like a snowball, as long as you keep doing it, it remains this nice solid consistency. But as soon as you stop and you look at your hands, it will start dripping all over you. So one of the games you can play here, and I sometimes do this with students, is I make a ball like that and I throw it at them. If they know what's coming at them and they do the same thing and throw it back, their hands will not get dirty. If they start staring at it, it's like, huh, what is this? Then it's all over the floor.
So there is torturing fifth graders, basically. And I'm sure their teachers appreciate that, too.
That's what you, that is like thinking on the spot.
He walks out before it has to be cleaned up, obviously. He's long gone.
Oh, I see.
And they get where
I just do the outreach.
Room. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So to that end, you told me about a great example of filling a pool with cornstarch.
Yeah, I've never done this myself.
Because the amount of
cornstarch required is beyond my research budget. But there is a great movie out on YouTube. And if you, I think, Pete, you put it on the website?
Yeah, we have linked it. If you go to today's show, you'll see a link there to this YouTube video.
So what this movie really shows is that the exact same stuff that I was talking about, something that has the consistency that if you try to deform it really quickly, it is like a solid, and if you do it slowly, it flows easily. They filled up a swimming pool like that. And what they can show you there is if you walk across it and you move your feet fast enough, you can actually walk across that pool. And that pool that they show in that video is probably filled with about 3 feet or maybe four feet of cornstarch. And you can even run in the same spot. As long as you keep your feet moving, and you can stand on one spot and you can keep your feet moving, you'll stand up. And then the guy stops walking and he just goes down. Boom. And he's all
covered with this stuff.
Covered with cornstarch.
Yeah. And it is easy to do. You can put a slurry of this in a cake pan, take a spoon, push it fast, and it will form a solid and crack. Push it slow, and you can stir it all day.
It's the same as I told the previous listener who called in, is you have to be very careful about what the exact amount of water is that you add. Really, when you get close to this consistency, you really need to add water one drop at a time. Because it is really a narrow range where this happens. If you have too much water in it, it's very runny, you won't see any of this. If that happens, you can just let it sit. The water will evaporate, and you can come back and try it again.
Well, so that's another property of these things. So, for example, you mentioned the shear thickening fluids. A lot of those are particles in a solvent.
Yep.
And that's true of a lot of these complex fluids and these materials that we use. They're not just one material dissolved in another at a molecular scale. They actually have what we like to call morphology or shape. They have bits of one phase in another, and they're suspended. And you mentioned a good example before that you can use with just a regular, you know, over-the-counter type microscope.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of these systems, why are they shear thinning and why are they shear thickening is because of the particles that are in there and how they interact with each other. And even with a standard elementary school microscope, you can see this. You can put different materials under the microscope with your kids and or yourself. But you might not want to talk about it in public.
I know. Bill and I will be trying this tonight, I'm sure.
And you put something like milk on it or diluted latex paint, and you actually see the tiny particles that make up the paint and the milk just bounce around. They just move around randomly. They're so small that they're just randomly jiggling around. You put something like mayonnaise on the microscope, and you see the the oil and water, the oil droplets in water under the microscope. And that's what gives structure to the mayonnaise. And you put a shaving cream on there, which are air bubbles in a liquid. And it really is it's pretty fun.
Right, and that's really just the difference between milk, butter, and mayonnaise. It's what's suspended at what size and what continuum.
Yeah, right? Because, I mean, obviously you know that all these products are made from the same raw material, what comes out of the cow, and you can make cheese out of it, and all you do is treat these ingredients slightly differently so that they get different, what we call, microstructures in there. To come back, by the way, to the shear thickening fluids, I mentioned the cornstarch example. Some researchers at the University of Delaware have actually used this phenomenon to make the next generation of both bulletproof and knife-proof vests. They beat Kevlar by taking some of these materials and taking simple nylon, impregnating it with these particles in liquid. And there are some amazing videos out there. I don't think you can find them on the web. I've never tried
Well, I've seen... what's our colleague at Delaware? I've seen his video.
Norman Wagner.
Yeah, I've seen Norm Wagner's video. Put a knife through something, you know, you put it through very, very rapidly, and you realize he can't do it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you can beat on an ice pick,
right?
And you cannot go through a fabric that was impregnated with these particles. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you try it with Kevlar, one of the problems with Kevlar is that it's bulletproof, but not knife-proof at all.
Right.
But these materials are, and it's obviously the research is now being funded by the Army. But it really started off as a clever Friday afternoon lab experiment.
Yeah. So basically, it shear thickens, right? So if you take something pointy, push it on there as you're shearing it, and you're shearing it at a rate that's fast for our time scale, slow by the standards of bullets, right? Yeah. So knives will go through something that is bulletproof. Now, let me see if I can think of the way to beat this, though. If you can get the guy, hold him down, and put that ice pick through him very, very, very slowly.
You will beat the system.
You will beat the system. But the point is, by that time, you probably could have dialed 911 on your cell phone.
Yeah.
And
patient.
Right, so there it is.
The patient serial killer wins out here.
Well,
right?
I'll see if I did see Norm Wagner's video, and it was amazing, him showing this knife not going through this stuff.
Let me ask a question that's related to food, since we're sitting here at lunch, and Pete didn't bring his pizza with him, so no, he's starving to death.
I am.
But when you make a roux for...
for etouffee?
Yeah.
We get a lot of cooking and painting themes here. Suddenly we're brain show.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong.
I have a right brain.
Okay.
Not sure about the left brain sometimes.
Are you from New Orleans? Are you
close enough? Okay. I'm from Mississippi, which we say the three biggest cities in Mississippi are Memphis, Atlanta, and New Orleans.
Okay, there you go.
Anyway, so you got the butter that you melt, and you put the flour and whatever the spices are mixed in.
Cajun style cooking.
Yeah,
with Bill Hunt.
Yeah, that's I make a really good etouffee. I actually do.
Okay.
But if you either don't fully mix it up, then you get clumps in the... So if you don't... Same way with using cornstarch in Chinese cooking.
Yeah, so lumps in the gravy or the stir fry.
They never go away. So what's going on with that?
Yeah, this has more to do with the problem that we run into the lab all the time as well, is trying to disperse particles properly. It's just a dispersion problem. By adding it in the wrong order, you cannot get the particles coated with the right kind of materials,
so
and they don't want to separate.
It works better
from each
if
other.
You just flake a little bit of cornstarch up off at a time and start. If you just dump it all in there and try to stir it up, you're not going to get there.
You have these big lumps of cornstarch that are so thick that the water doesn't come in anymore.
They never go away. Okay.
And with the roux, what is key is that you get it in the butter really, really well before you add any kind of other liquid.
Right. Just the butter.
Butter helps to break these particles apart.
Then you add water afterwards, and it all sort of thickens the water up afterwards.
And of course, once it bursts into flames, you've probably ever done it, Bill. That's all I'm saying. All right, we're going to take a segue from cooking Cajun. We've got a caller in the line.
Yeah, I think some stuff about painting.
He's hungry.
More painting.
This person is hungry.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Can we get you to speak up a little? We can barely hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry. Is that better?
That's much better. Welcome to Inside the Black Box. Did you have a question or comment?
I'm on the job site. Let me get out of my truck.
Okay, that'll do it.
How about now?
That's good. What was your question or comment?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
We're here. You're here.
I'm here.
Yeah. Can you hear us?
Can you hear us?
He cannot hear us.
He
can he not hear us?
Is there reason?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello?
Hello.
Apparently he's not hearing
Trent,
us.
Can you hear us?
I don't know.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, what's your question?
Go ahead. I wanted to recap on the question that the caller called in about canvas and the elasticity of the paint and cleaning brushes. And when you're cleaning brushes, if you have the residuals left over, it's because you're probably using a latex paint in a boar hair brush. And the boar hair brush has more open spaces in it where that stuff clings to. So therefore, if you use a nylon brush and latex paint, it cleans a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And you use a boar brush, which was, you know, hog hair, and oil paints. And linseed oil, if you use linseed oil in the cleaning method of it, you got to remember, linseed oil was one of the first, was came after what they call shellac.
Right.
Which is also a natural varnish.
Mm-hmm.
So if you use it in your brushes, and when it dries, your brushes will be stiff.
Okay, because it's hardened on the surface of the brush, or because it's absorbed into those pores?
It's absorbed into the pores.
Yeah.
That's why if you use nylon, it's man-made, so therefore it has a much closed cell built-up in it. So therefore, it cleans easier.
And this comes back to a very fundamental issue, is that for all these particles, is how they interact with each other, if they stick to each other and also stick to the surfaces, is ultimately going to determine if these processes work or not. So that's a very, very good practical suggestion, and there is a good scientific explanation for that, is that nylon indeed likes water better, so that's why you don't get these latex particles sticking to it as much.
Right.
And then the porosity just adds to that.
And then if you get a brush that just gets worn out, but it happens to be a favorite brush of yours that you just can't let go of, there's a product out on the market, and you can't find it at your local, you know, Big Orange or your Big Blue store, but, you know, you go to an independent paint store, and it's just called New Brush. And
do they tell you what it is?
Well, it gives it the statistics and, and the VOCs on the back of it and everything, but... it's a brush restorer is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is coming from a third generation painter and everything. Yeah. And I do nothing but custom hand finished painting,
right,
interior wise and such. But, you know, I'm just one of those type of people, you know, that I got brushes that I've had probably for about 10, 15 years.
Really?
And they still look like they're brand new.
You're kidding. I got to take lessons from you, because I used a brush once, try to clean it up, and then I got to throw it away.
Another good thing, too, that a lot of people miss the mark on is when you're cleaning your brush, you know, I take a wire brush to them and clean them when I clean them. That's how you get the paint out of the heel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the heel is what's up next to what, you know, the metal band.
Right.
So, you know, that's how you get the paint out of the heel of the brush. You know, because if you don't get the paint out of the heel, eventually you'll start feeling that part of the bristles, and it'll start getting stiffer and stiffer, and it'll keep gradually working down to the tip of the brush to where, well, you just figure, well, the brush is 86, throw it away.
Yeah. Well, listen, we need to wrap up the show, but thanks so much for giving us a call.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Empirical knowledge, something that obviously Bill and myself are not very good at.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
We could talk about the fundamentals. But the empirical stuff.
Well,
right?
Somebody's been doing it for a long time, knows all these old tricks that probably are getting to be a lost art.
But you're right. Boar's hair brush, natural product, lots of pores. Nylon, as Victor mentioned, it actually has these little hydrogen bonding groups on it, so it likes the water, not the rubbery latex. But it also crystallizes like nobody's business, so it has no pores.
I think it was soldiers in World War II that figured this out with the nylons and the paints.
Right, and obviously Bill hasn't figured it out yet.
To me, yeah.
No.
Okay,
do I ever?
But it's
no,
a good example of things that people have been doing for a long time by experience. Like cheese making was one of those cases where people knew for a long time how to make cheese. But the science of cheese making, what really happens on the molecular level, has not been revealed
for
that long.
It's actually quite complex. Same with ice cream. Ice cream, to me, is one of the most complex fluids there is. Right, the number of you got ice crystals, you got fat particles, you got protein particles, you got water. It's
everybody knows the difference between a good and a bad ice cream.
Right, 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 Right. So there you have it. And this is something we often try to stress on the show, the difference between fundamental and empirical knowledge. We got some good empirical knowledge from our two callers coming in.
Right.
Which explains why, you know, we don't have that. Mm-hmm. Bill can't clean his brushes.
Right.
But at least we can tell you why you can't clean your brushes.
Right.
And a
right.
lot of the consumer companies that we've been talking about, they connect, they have research going on, fundamental research, but ultimately their product is tested by a consumer panel.
Right.
And it's all about feel,
texture, like our,
if they like
our
it or
artist
not.
Caller talked about. Texture is really big.
Right.
All right, so to wrap up then, gentlemen, and I use that term with great poetic license, what have we learned today? I mean, I think we've learned that there are lots of things in between solids and liquids.
Right.
And these fall in this form of complex foods, right? They're all over consumer products.
Yeah.
Right, they've obviously got the painting community very excited.
And it's kind of not in the chemistry of it per se. It's not like there's a chemical reaction.
Right.
It's in the ordering of those
The
pieces.
The packing of these molecules, this microstructure that Victor talked about.
Right.
And the more important thing is there are plenty of examples from looking at things like shaving cream or milk underneath a microscope to putting cornstarch into a pan where you can illustrate these things all the time.
Right.
Do we leave anything out, Victor?
Don't forget the K effect.
And the K effect, which will keep Bill busy in his shower for months to come.
Oh, yeah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's thank Victor for being on the program. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Welcome.
And next week on Inside the Black Box, we'll have Alan Tannenbaum talking about medical imaging way beyond X-ray specs, and he'll be discussing the virtual colon fly-through.
Not my colon specifically.
A non-invasive diagnostic technique, or the new ride at Six Flags over Georgia. Thanks again for joining us on Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta.